I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. I welcome John Yoo, the author of the new book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. John is also a professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley. He's at the Hoover Institution. He's at AEI. But right now he's an author to explain how it is the subtitle works perfectly. Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. Fight, a struggle. Being president is not enough. The Constitution is inside each of these chapters. John, congratulations and good evening. And I take you immediately to your third chapter, Revolt of the Bureaucracy and the Foreign Service. This is a way of reviewing what we witnessed. And wasn't it just 10 minutes ago before the virus? What we witnessed between the late summer and early fall of 2019 and the impeachment trial that began 2020 in another world before the virus, because you make the very careful point that the bureaucracy and the Foreign Service rose up to gather around a so-called whistleblower who had no standing. Had no standing. Please explain, John, how a whistleblower, a man never named in the major media, and a man who's said to be a part of the CIA, how he assumed that he could challenge the President of the United States as if he was a colleague. Good evening, John.
Oh, good evening, John. Thanks for having me back. And it's great to be able to talk with you about the book. I thought this was a way to understand what was really happening with impeachment, just in what was really happening with the Mueller investigation, too, aside from the day-to-day political trench warfare in Washington, besides the spectacle of watching Trump fight for his political life. And you take a step back and look at it in constitutional terms, what happened? This was a revolt of the bureaucracy, of the Foreign Service, of the intelligence agencies, right? But why? Because they think they are the elite. They think they are the experts. And what they don't like is someone from the outside, an unpracticed person with no experience, person who doesn't think well of them, who comes in brash like the proverbial bull in the china shop, and introduces a completely different way of doing foreign policy, introduces a different sense of what America's goals in the world should be, wants to be more modest, wants to have to pull back from the American role in the world. And you had a rebellion, right? You had career bureaucrat after career bureaucrat paraded in front of the House impeachment investigation to say that they didn't like Donald Trump and the way he did business. To me, constitutionally, what that was an effort by this bureaucracy that's been created for decades and decades, ever since the New Deal, if not going all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, trying to shrug off, to get rid of a political leader who was trying to impose control on them because he had been elected president of the United States.
The concern I have is that they are members of the executive branch of government, to my reading. You mentioned the Foreign Service, for example, part of the State Department, the CIA, part of the national security apparatus. That means that they're under the umbrella of the President of the United States, who gives them the authority to act in his name. Therefore, how is it that they were that we saw, that we witnessed permission given by the legislative branch? That's the impeachment process. And initially it was led by Adam Schiff, who didn't tell the whole story about how he had recruited members of the executive branch. But in any event, how is it that the legislative branch was able to use the executive branch against the president? Is that in the Constitution? Did the founders anticipate that there would be a teaming up to go after someone they both don't like?
No, it's a great point, John, because one thing that I think the Constitution should remind us is that those functions, foreign policy, intelligence, national security, the military, under the text of the Constitution, control over those issues, the execution and formulation of policy, all falls under Article 2 of the Constitution, which is the branch headed solely by the president. And it's the president's constitutional duties to carry out those functions. Everyone who works in the executive branch is an assistant or subordinate who is there to aid the president. And if they don't do it, then he can remove them and replace them with people who will. But at the same time, how did this happen? How did we get to a world where we saw parts of the executive branch rise up against the president and try to cooperate, feed information to Congress, to remove that president. I think that is the product of, I think, the great blemish on the constitutional design, which is this administrative state. It doesn't fit into the Constitution. But with Woodrow Wilson and the philosophers of the progressive era at the turn of the 20th century, and then perfected or at least pushed along significantly by FDR and then LBJ, the idea was, no, government shouldn't be under the control of the politicians, that dirty, messy politicking of elections. We have to have an independent body that conducts foreign policy, that makes decisions not politically, not based on costs and benefits are balancing. They're going to make decisions because they're experts, and they have to be insulated and protected from politics, and they should be independent of political control. It is not in the Constitution at all, but that is the guiding philosophy for many of these large agencies that control trillions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of employees, and they don't want to be told what to do by somebody like a Donald Trump.
The FBI, this is a subset of the revolt of the bureaucracy. I like the idea of reducing the FBI to an equivalent to the Foreign Service. Okay, fine. It's the Foreign Service with guns. I get that. Fine. But still, the Steele dossier, McCabe, Comey, I'm not even going to explicate this. I'm just going to rattle off names. Okay, Rosenstein, Mueller, Brennan, on and on and on. What you identify here is that they came together to follow a narrative that proved to be a hoax, a fiction, a make-believe, a complete falsehood. However, at any point, the president had the authority to fire them because he regarded their work as incomplete or inadequate or dishonest. Is that correct, John?
Yes. Again, it is almost the same game plan that was used with impeachment. Again, you had people, Jim Comey and the headquarters staff of the FBI, who, although under the Constitution, they are supposed to be working for the president. Only the president has a constitutional power and responsibility to, as the Constitution says, take care that the laws are faithfully executed. Everyone who works in the FBI and the Justice Department is an assistant to the president in executing the laws. But this bureaucracy, the National Security Law Enforcement bureaucracy, the FBI, thought that they had the right to decide who was fit or not fit to hold the office of the president, notwithstanding what the people said in the 2016 elections. And so they revolted too. And to do it, they, I think, as you suggested, we're finding out now how manufactured this Steele dossier was, how the flimsiest of evidence, really no evidence, was used to get search warrants and surveillance on the members of the Republican Party's presidential campaign. Imagine if Republicans had done that to the Democrats. Well, that's what we would call Watergate. And then to the remarkable thing is to continue that investigation and try to entrap not just members like Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, but try to investigate and entrap Trump himself after he had already won the election and after he had taken office. So again, to me, it was an effort by this bureaucracy that did not want to fall under political control as required by the Constitution. They thought they knew better. They thought they were above politics in some way, and they thought that Donald Trump was a threat to the established way of doing business.
And John, quickly, if I understand correctly, because the president has the power to fire them, that's a corrective to their misconduct. He did not use it, but that's built into the Constitution, the presumption that the president will defend his office from people who are misleading the public. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. I mean, it's not just, although it is Donald Trump's favorite tagline, right? You're fired. But actually goes back to President Washington and the founders. You'll look in the Constitution, it actually doesn't have a provision that says the president orders and the FBI director obeys, or the president orders and the secretary of state obeys. The only way that presidents and the Supreme Court have said that the chief executive can control all those people who work in the executive branch to make sure they don't deviate from policy, to make sure they follow presidential orders, the only thing he can do is to fire officers who don't listen to him. So, yes, he's fired Comey. He probably could have fired far more many people than he did. But that has got to be an unrestricted presidential right, because otherwise you'll have people, cabinet secretaries, commission leaders, who just go off and do what they feel like and are no way accountable to the voters. At least the voters hold the president accountable, so he has the political incentive to make sure that our, you know, mandate, the agenda that we want as the people, is carried out by our government.
John Yoo is the author of the new book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. We go immediately to the border, the wall, when we come back. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. John Yoo, professor of law at University of California, Berkeley, is the author of a new book, Defender-in-Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. John, we go to the wall because the borders are the purview of the president to defend, the sovereign borders of the United States. Congress is not in charge, although it can pass laws. The president is in charge. You go through three iterations of the president defending the borders, the travel ban, the wall itself, and birthright citizenship. But I want to hang this on something from the 18th century, thanks to your reporting. This is Federalist 23. That's Alexander Hamilton. No constraints, no constraint, no constitution shackle, no constitutional shackles can be wisely imposed on the president. Is not that what we witnessed when Congress denied the president the power to build a wall or to allocate funds to build the wall? I believe he used the National Emergency Act of 1976. Was Congress not then offending Federalist 23?
Yes, it's a great point, John, that you should ask, why do we have a president at all? Why don't we just have just a bunch of ministers who work for Congress? The framers rejected that idea. They created for the first time this independent chief executive elected by the people and not elected by Congress. The question is why? Because they wanted the president to be able to immediately react, to have energy in the executive, in the words of the Federalists, to be able to respond swiftly and decisively and quickly to unforeseen circumstances, emergencies, to events on the ground. And so President Trump has been trying to do that. And I think in a way that's consistent with his predecessors. One of the things that I found remarkable about the attacks on President Trump is how far people on the left would go, progressives would go, in arguments claiming that President Trump had no power, that President Trump was the one violating the Constitution. But when you look at really what Trump was doing, he was acting within the bounds of what past presidents have done. Other presidents have also declared national emergencies and have been able to move money around. In fact, Congresses of the past have supported presidents in doing that. I don't think President Trump was by any means beyond his powers when he decided to move money from one account to from building accounts for the military and shifted it to a border wall. And the more important thing is the bigger picture again. President Trump, I think, is reminding us that the United States is a sovereign nation. Sovereign nations control their borders. They decide who comes in and out of the country and what criteria. We can have fights of how many people and what the criteria should be, but it's President Trump's opponents who make the truly radical arguments that even having a border is immoral and that it's illegal for there to be a border patrol that's going to enforce immigration laws that Congress has passed and that Congress has funded, or that somehow the United States should not be in the business of removing people who enter the country illegally, when that's what every other country in the world does, and that's the very meaning of being a nation and having sovereignty is.
Sovereignty also includes treaties. So I want to do quickly here. John takes me to George Washington, his cabinet of Hamilton, Jefferson, Knox, and others. George Washington put the question to each of them, what shall I do about the 1778 treaties of alliance with France now that the revolution has rendered France incoherent? The execution, the defenestration of the government we allied with. The president has the power to break treaties. George Washington was seeking counsel. He resolved it in his fashion, and yet President Trump, in breaking treaties that he regarded as irregular, have been challenged, let's see, the Iran deal, certainly, the INF Treaty, the New START Treaty, the NAFTA Treaty, the TPP Treaty, well, I could go on. You understand. Is not the purview of the president, the power of the president, solely for treaties? The Senate's advise and consent is not to make treaties. It's to advise the president on his treaties. Have I read it correctly?
Yes, and more importantly, the Senate advice and consent role only goes to the making of treaties, not the termination. Just the way the Senate gives its advice and consent for cabinet officers and appointments, but they're not involved with firing them, you know, the reversing of an appointment. And you're quite right. Again, it's a question of sovereignty. And I think this is a difference, between the last president and this one. The last president, President Obama, had a lot of faith in multilateral treaties and international cooperation. I think a lot of countries took advantage, Russia, China, Iran, took advantage of us during this, I think, period. And I think what Trump is trying to do is, as part of reasserting sovereignty, is to remind us that as a sovereign nation, we pursue our self-interest and other nations are going to, too. We can cooperate, but that also means we shouldn't just stay stuck in treaties that don't make any sense anymore. And so just as when it comes to managing the bureaucracy, Trump has loved to use his power to fire, when it comes to foreign affairs, what he's been trying to do is free up American ability to maneuver. And by doing it, he's terminating treaties, as you said, and you could have thrown in the Paris Accords for global warming, too. But I think that's going to be the difference between a first term and if there's a second term, because in a second term, we'd want to see what is Trump going to do on the positive front to now increase cooperation among new allies, along new networks and new places, really, I think, focused on China rather than trying to create a kind of universal government and to bind the United States down in this web of treaties, mostly, I think, inspired by European views of the world.
I'm speaking to John Yoo about his book, Defender in Chief. And quickly, John, we'll tuck in the pardon power. We have about a minute. The president's power is to pardon. We've seen him use it routinely these last days because of the Russiagate falsehoods. However, again, he's challenged. You make it very clear when he pardoned Scooter Libby, for example, you make it very clear that the founding fathers meant to give the president that power, including self-pardon. Is that correct? We have a minute, John.
Yeah, in fact, I think this is something hard for people to understand, that there can be an absolute power in the president, and pardons are one of them. You know, Trump pardoned Roger Stone. I don't know if I would have pardoned Roger Stone, but right after that, Nancy Pelosi said, we're going to pass a law to make sure that could never happen again. Well, that's just flatly unconstitutional. But there's a broader reason for it. The president has to be there to be able to stop prosecutions, to commute sentences, not just out of mercy, but because it might be important to break up conspiracies against the government. And the founders knew that a president might abuse that power, but they still thought it was important enough for these other reasons for the president to have it and to have it on his own.
John Yoo is the author of the new book, Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. When we come back, we're going to turn to the courts, the Supreme Court. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. John Yoo, professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley. His new book is Defender in Chief, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. We've not had a chance to go through all of the chapters, but the one that is certainly raw right now and unresolved, even after a recent Supreme Court decision that sent it back to lower courts, as I understand, is the DAPA, DACA, the so-called Dreamers. And John, I didn't go to law school, so I'm going to present this in an encapsulated form, and you correct me. The question here is prosecutorial discretion and the power of the president under the Take Care Clause. Prosecutorial discretion meaning the president, President Obama, resolved that the laws about being without documents in the United States would not be applied. They would not be used by prosecutors. And the president took that power upon himself and declined to enforce the law. That itself is a constitutional question. Is that correct, John? And how did President Trump resolve it?
That's a good thing you didn't go to law school, because you're able to understand and explain it far more clearly than a graduate of a law school. No, exactly. The immigration laws set basically a quota on how many people can come in on what grounds. President Obama disagreed. He thought, and I support the policy of it, you know, that these dreamers, children who were brought here, who didn't know any better, in violation of the immigration laws, should have some way to stay. But I think President Trump thinks, too, the Constitution leaves that question up to Congress. That's a legislative decision. It's always been understood to be a decision of Congress. Nevertheless, President Obama came in and he said, well, I'm just not going to enforce that law. I'm going to use my discretion over what cases to bring, how many resources to spend. As you say, it's called prosecutorial discretion. I'm going to reduce enforcement of the immigration laws there to zero. I thought that was unconstitutional back in 2012 when he proposed that, in 2014 when he expanded it. I think President Trump said so, too. And so when he came into office, he said, I'm not doing that anymore. One of the important powers of a president is to reverse the decisions of the last president. I would have thought that was constitutional. The remarkable thing, as you mentioned, John, is that the Supreme Court just a few weeks ago said, no, President Trump can't stop DACA and DAPA. He has to keep doing something he thinks is unconstitutional. He has to undergo this much more burdensome process called the Administrative Procedure Act, which can take years to undo President Obama's DACA policy. Now, I think that might have been a short-term political loss for Trump, but it actually hands him quite a bit of power, because think about what President Trump can do. If he decides, I don't feel like enforcing this law, I don't feel like enforcing that law, he could actually reorient the immigration laws to a completely different kind of criteria, one that's skills-based, one that hands out visas, essentially work permits, for anyone who's here with a STEM degree, or lets people stay in the country who bring millions of dollars and invest in American business, thereby changing the nature and focus of our immigration laws entirely. In other words, and I think this is a feature of the attacks on Trump, is the attacks sort of treat that there should be a kind of law that only applies to Trump but to no other presidents and vice versa. And what I say is, if the Supreme Court means what it says, if these arguments mean what they say, then search replace Obama with Trump or vice versa, and ask, do you still agree with it? And I think in this case, if this power is good enough for Obama, it's got to be good enough for Trump, too.
John Locke talked about the prerogative power. Now, John Locke is not a founding father. I understand that. Fine. He didn't even live here. But the prerogative power includes for an executive to act because there's no law, absent a law, and to act in violation of the law. Is the prerogative power in the Constitution?
John, that's one of the tough questions that goes back to the very beginning of our country and our Constitution, and presidents have had different views. Thomas Jefferson thought it did not. So Thomas Jefferson was faced with the opportunity to buy Louisiana, the Louisiana Purchase. How could he resist it? Any American loves a good deal. You could get Louisiana and the vast territories there for pennies on the dollar, pennies on the acre. He didn't think in the Constitution there was a power for him to add that much territory to the United States. So he said, I will exercise a prerogative power, but I admit what I'm doing might be illegal. And I ask the people to ratify my decision or not, reject me at the next election. The other side of the debate is Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln, at the outset of the Civil War, again, something that was not foreseen by the founders. There's no provisions in the Constitution about separation and what to do when one part of the country takes arms against the other. Abraham Lincoln could have said, I have to exercise a prerogative power to take necessary actions, even if they're not in the Constitution or even if they're against the Constitution. Lincoln didn't say that. Lincoln said, all the powers as president I need to put down the rebellion are in the executive power clause, and then the clause you mentioned, the take care clause and the commander in chief clause. But it's all, and that was Hamilton's view too. The Constitution has enough power in it to handle emergencies and crises, to handle necessity. But others like Jefferson didn't think so. They thought the Constitution doesn't prepare for every necessity, and so they wanted to act outside the Constitution because they thought, in a weird way, they wouldn't stretch and bend it too far.
going to war, declaring war. I have to. John's taught me to be very careful what verb is used, okay? Declaring war. It's an important verb here. All right. Congress first, then the president acts. But if I understand, what Donald Trump has done is that he's confounded Congress because he's unwarring. He's withdrawing from conflict. And therefore, Congress, routinely unhappy, fine, they're always unhappy. Does Congress yeah. have the authority to get involved in the unwarring, the calling back, the stepping away from theater? Or is this entirely a presidential authority that nobody ever dreamed about? You can stop a president from going to war, but can you stop a president from not going to war?
That's a great question, John, and it shows how Trump really shows a new direction in constitutional law and politics, in the sense that we were obsessed in the past about presidents going too far, presidents waging war in places Congress disagreed, or making agreements that Congress didn't want him to make. But can Congress actually, and this I think it shows really the nature of executive power. Nothing Congress can do can really stop a president who doesn't want to fight a war that Congress wants, who wants to withdraw from parts of the world where Congress wants to keep troops. I mean, Congress can't force a president to decide how to use his commander-in-chief power. Congress can't force the president to sign treaties that the president doesn't want to sign. So this is I think that really shows on the flip side how people who had criticized past presidents had gone too far, claiming, presidents need Congress's permission to use force or so or this or that. Because when you see it on the other side of things, we all, I think, recognize you can't have Congress deciding where troops are going to go and where they're going to fight. That's got to be a presidential decision. Also shows that Trump's, I think this is a part of the book, this was the part of the book that was hardest for me to write, was to try to figure out what is the Trump doctrine. And in some ways, I think it is this reassertion of national sovereignty, the idea that we're going to be a normal nation, we're going to have limited means, we're going to have limited ends in foreign policy, we're not going to be the policeman for the world, but we're going to pull back and try to live within our means. And that's going to require us to pull troops out of other places and maybe redeploy them to confront other rising challenges from other countries like China. But that really is something that's up to the president. And Congress can support it. Congress can make it easier to do. But I don't think Congress can really stop it.
Defender in Chief is the new book, Donald Trump's Fight for Presidential Power. John Yoo, professor of law at the University of California at Berkeley and part of the AEI and part of the Hoover Institution as well. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show.